We do greet all of our guests today, and we're glad that you're here. It's a special time of kind of getting back together as school is about to start and we're getting moving forward. But we have also some very special guests that are here. Jim and Judy Garrington. You've already seen Jim playing the bass up there, one of his many talents. Jim and Judy Garrington are the angels that God sent before we came. In 1988, when my wife and I and three children came to Germany, we needed help. We didn't know the language. Actually, I thought I knew one word. I thought Gesundheit meant God bless you. But then I found out it only means health. So we got an apartment, miraculously. We got a phone after a couple tries. And I remember the day that the phone rang. And I had this feeling like, okay, that's a German phone. Somebody's calling that number that nobody should know. Probably a German. And I don't speak German, so what should I do? Should I pick it up or not? You know, and I actually debated for a while, like, I don't know. But I picked it up, and it was Jim Garrington on the phone. Said we had found out that you were coming to town and thought we would just call and greet you. And wow, what a tremendous help that was to us. I am not sure, Jim and Judy, if we would have stayed had you guys not been around. You were God sent. They were the directors of the Salvation Army men's home and ministry here at that time. And we have had great friendship. They had three children with them at that time, our three children, and they would get together. I remember the rule at their house was the children had to speak English because they were all in German schools and they would speak German naturally. So it was kind of fun to hear Judy call down the hallway and say, I hear German down there. You're supposed to be speaking English. But over the years, Jim and Judy have been a tremendous encouragement to us. They have moved to various places around Germany and America. And we're just delighted to have you here for a couple days with us. We thank God for sending you ahead so that we had some opportunity to stay here. We are concluding a series. Good time to conclude a series right before a retreat. The series is Wisdom for Today, and everybody wants wisdom, except those people who think they already know everything, and that's not very many people. But we have been looking at the five wisdom books in the middle of the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, there is the history and the history of how God chose a man and a nation to bring salvation into the world. There are the prophets that told about that man coming and what changes there would be in the world. And right in the middle, the heart of the Old Testament, there are five books of poetry. Now, sometimes we don't recognize them as poetry because we don't recognize the form. And I've talked about that on various other occasions. But they're not only just poetry for poetry's sake, they are poetry that instruct us. In fact, if you want to know how to endure suffering, you need to read the poem that is called Job, and you will learn. If you want to know how to pray and how to praise, because the book of Psalms has both those psalms of lamentation, of sorrow, and those psalms of great praise. If you want to know how to pray and praise, read the book of Psalms. Read it over and over again. Let it permeate your very life. If you want to know how to live righteously, make right decisions, then you should read the book of Proverbs. It is how to live righteously. Last week, we looked at Ecclesiastes, how to enjoy life. Now, I know when you first read Ecclesiastes and it says vanity, vanity, all is vanity, you might miss that, but you need to dig in deeper and see that he says there are things that as we evaluate them, those are the gifts God has given us to be able to enjoy life, and we need to rightly evaluate things. And today we want to look at the last of that series of books, and it's called the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs of Solomon, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. How to love. If you want to know how to love. Now, Someone else has looked at these five and said, well, there's another way of looking at them, and I really like it as well, because as humans, we are not just one thing. You know, we're not animals. We're not just a happenstance. We were created by God, and we have a spirit that relates to God and will live eternally with God. And it is the spirit that cries out to God, and that is really the picture of what Job's all about. He said, where is God? I would love to come before him. I would love to talk to him face to face. And he gets that opportunity. But we also have a soul. And someone has said the soul is made up of the mind and the emotions and the will. And if you look at that, the emotions are expressed in Psalms. Any kind of emotion you can think of is expressed in the Psalms. You will find Psalms wonderful places to express your emotions. The will is choices that you're going to make. You'll find that in Proverbs, how to make right choices. And the mind, in Ecclesiastes, he was searching. He looked into wealth and it didn't satisfy. He looked in pleasure and it didn't satisfy. He looked into all these different things. He was using his mind to search out. But the Song of Solomon relates to the body. We are not just souls. We are not just spirits. We have bodies. And too often, the church has taken the stance of, we don't talk about that here. And I want us to understand that God's design is beautiful and pure and right and good. And the book of the Song of Solomon is about God's love and how it's designed. We'll talk about some different ways to decipher and to interpret it. But basically, if you read it, by the way, if you were in the Jewish family of growing up, you would not be able to read it until you were 30. So if some of you are under 30, I don't know. You know, it's a little above you. It is often read at Jewish weddings. It is read at Passover time among the Jews. It is read in lots of love letters. If you guys want to figure out some words to write some love letters, you could find it right there in the Bible and send it to her. She might not understand it, though, if you say her neck is like a tower. You might have to explain some of those things. But that's what we want to look. Now, we have the video. Again, if you cannot see that screen well, please move up so you can see it. These videos are worth seeing. It's a short video introducing Song of Solomon.
The Song of Songs.
Start again.
The Song of Songs. It's a well-known but not so well-understood book of the Bible. It's 8 chapters of love poetry. And while there is an introduction and a conclusion, the book doesn't have any kind of rigid literary design, and that's because it's a collection of poems. They're not meant to be dissected or taken apart. They're meant to be read as a flowing whole and simply enjoyed. The first line of the book tells us that it's the Song of Songs, which is a Hebrew idiom, like the Holy of Holies or the King of Kings. It's a Hebrew way of saying the greatest thing. So this is the greatest song of all songs. Then we're told in the first line that this Song of Songs is of Solomon, which could mean that he's the author. His name does begin the book, after all. But as you read the poems, you discover that the main voice is that of a woman called the Beloved. And while there is also a male voice, it does not seem to be Solomon's. Solomon is mentioned a couple times in the poems, but he's never a speaker. And you do have to admit, Solomon is a very odd candidate as the author of this book, given the fact that he had 700 wives. For the lovers in the Song of Songs, they are the only ones in the world for each other. So the of Solomon likely means in the wisdom tradition of Solomon. He was known for his wisdom, his poetry, his love of learning about every part of life. And Solomon became the father of wisdom literature in Israel. And so his legacy is here carried on through a collection of love poems that explores the human experience of love and sexual desire. The opening poem introduces us to the basic theme of this book. We hear the voice of the young woman who delights in her man, a shepherd. Now, she's not married to him yet, but it becomes clear that they're engaged and they cannot wait to be together. From the introduction, the poems flow back and forth from the woman's voice to the man's, shifting from scene to scene without any kind of clear linear sequence or storyline. The poems move in these symphonic cycles, and key images and ideas get repeated and developed. So, one of the basic themes uniting the poems is the intense desire that this couple has for each other, expressed through their constant seeking and finding. So after the opening poem, they're separated but on the hunt for one another. So the woman calls out, or she'll wake up from a dream or go looking for her lover. And more than once, they'll find each other. They'll embrace. And then right when things start to get a bit racy, the scene will suddenly end and a new one will start. They're separated, looking for each other, and on it goes. Another repeated theme is the joy of the couple's physical attraction for one another. So multiple times, they'll pause and describe each other with these elaborate metaphors. And here it's very helpful to know that these images and metaphors in Hebrew poetry are not primarily visual. If you try and paint a picture of these people based on the metaphors, you will end up with something that looks very, very strange. What you're supposed to do is reflect on the meaning of these images as they relate to the man and the woman. So you'll read through the poetic cycles, and the tension will keep building in their desire and joy and attraction. And this spiraling repetition is a poetic way of heightening and focusing on the mystery and power of sexual love. It all comes together in the conclusion, which pauses to summarize what these poems are all about. Love is as strong as death. Its passions are as severe as the grave. Its flashes are of fire, a divine flame. Many waters cannot extinguish love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, he would be utterly scorned. The poem highlights the power and the intensity of love, how it's both beautiful but also dangerous. Like fire, love can destroy people if it's abused, or be life-giving if it's protected. Ultimately, love expresses the insatiable human longing to know and be fully known and desired by another. Love is one of the most transcendent and mysterious experiences in human life, and as a part of the Bible's wisdom tradition, this book says it's a gift from God. After this, there's an odd poem about Solomon trying to do what the previous poem just said was impossible, to buy love. The woman rejects Solomon's offer, and then the book concludes with the man and the woman. They're separate once more on the hunt for each other. He calls to hear her voice. She begs him to run away with her, and that's how the book ends. Just totally open-ended. But that's a lot like love, which never truly concludes, because there's always more to discover and pursue in your beloved. And so true love has no end, and neither does this book. Now, through history, the big question raised by the Song of Songs is, what on earth is love poetry doing in the Bible? There have been three main interpretations of this book throughout history. In Jewish tradition, it's been read as an allegory, each character a symbol. So the woman is Israel, the man is God, and their love is a symbol of the covenant between God and Israel made at Mount Sinai in the giving of the Torah. This view flowed into the Christian tradition, but the characters were swapped. So it's about Christ's love for his people, the church. And this interpretation was inspired by Paul's words in Ephesians 5, that a Christian husband's love for his wife is a symbol of Christ's love for the church. What's interesting is that in the last 100 years, archaeological discoveries among Israel's ancient neighbors in Egypt and Babylon has turned up all kinds of ancient love poetry that's very similar in language and imagery to the Song of Songs. We see that love poetry was a meaningful part of Israel's cultural environment, which has led most scholars today to view the Song of Songs as what it presents itself to be, an arrangement of Israelite love poetry reflecting on the divine gift of love. But that doesn't mean that it's only ancient love poetry. There's a key feature of these poems that sticks out when you read them as a part of the Old Testament, and that's the overwhelming use of garden imagery. There are powerful echoes of the Garden of Eden and the idyllic scene between the married couple in the early chapters of Genesis. So the image of the man and the woman naked and vulnerable, but completely unified and safe with one another, this resonates in the background of the Song of Songs. It's as if in these poems we are witnessing the love of a couple whose relationship is untainted by selfishness and sin. And so ultimately the song holds out hope that even though our own relationships are so often distorted by selfishness, love is a transcendent gift. And it's meant to point us to something greater, to the gift of God's love that will one day permeate and transform His beloved world. And that's what the Song of Songs is all about.
I just recognized the fact that I did not put the website on that page for you. If you would like to have that, I would be glad to give it to you. You can actually just go to the internet and put Read Scripture, Song of Songs, and it will come up. This is an excellent series. I've used them during this series. We won't be using them forever. But I do recommend them and recommend that you look into them to kind of get a handle on books, maybe before you begin to study into books. So let's review quickly some of the things that we've learned here. The title is Solomon's Song of Songs, but it could mean that Solomon collected the songs or that he wrote them. But it seems, as the video has said, it seems a little strange that a man with 700 wives and 300 concubines would write about one man and one woman having such deep love for each other. If Solomon, then it must be either early, before he had many wives and concubines, or very late as a longing for God's plan of one man and one woman. Either case would fit. It is called the Supreme Song of Love. It's the Song of Songs about love. The internal clues cause us to date it early in Solomon's reign, because the mention of different cities, there's a number of cities mentioned, it doesn't talk about them in terms of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. So the division was not there. In fact, the capital of the northern kingdom of Samaria is not mentioned at all. So it wasn't even established or wasn't important in those days. So we tend to believe that Solomon, if he's the writer of this, wrote this very early in his reign. Now, the form is like a theatrical or a musical. Everybody loves the musical, right? And so it seems like there are certain voices, the maiden, Shulamite, the shepherd, the King Solomon. And note that Solomon and Shulamite are the masculine and feminine names of the same word. So it could be Mr. and Mrs. If you wanted to translate it that way, that would be okay. And then there's a chorus. The chorus is the daughters of Jerusalem or the wise voices. And it always kind of troubled me that you interpret it that she loved the shepherd, but the king came. But then it seems like at the very beginning, she did marry the king. And all that's kind of hard to put together. And I came up with a solution that somebody else suggested, and I looked into it a little more. I think it actually fits. Is that there was a time in Solomon's life when he disguised himself as not as a king, but he would go out and work among the people so he could see what they needed. And there was a possibility, this is just a possible thought, that as he was working as a shepherd, that the two of them fell in love and longed for each other. Then they were separated. And then when the king comes and says, I want to see this girl, and she says, no, I'm sorry, I'm already in love with the shepherd. She falls in love when she finds out that the shepherd is really the king. That also fits if you're using the allegory system, because Jesus is our shepherd, but he is also our king. And so it can fit both ways. Personally, I like that because it helps us to put it together. What am I saying? Is there not a right and wrong answer? That's right. There is not a right and wrong answer in reading this. We'll look at the interpretations in a minute and realize that they could be right and right, not necessarily right and wrong. If it's a play, a musical play, where they're singing these songs, because that's what they are, to each other, most agree that there are three scenes. There were before the marriage, the wedding, and the consummation of the marriage, and then later in the marriage. And in those scenes, there's a number of acts that come up. The problem is, as you saw on the illustration, they don't follow linearly. They're not in a line, okay? Sometimes there's going back. And sometimes it looks like it's not reality that's being taught, and I think that's a good way of understanding it. Sometimes she's dreaming, and she dreams that he's not there. And then and when she awakens, he wasn't there or he's gone. And other times there seems to be like a vision. And so it is a hard one to line out, to put A, B, C, D on. And it shouldn't be read that way. It should be read as a beautiful love poetry that helps us to understand a number of things. Interpretation could be one of three different ways, as was mentioned. It could be allegorical. In other words, it could be a beautiful story that has a hidden meaning. Not so well hidden, because the Jews all agreed that this is a story about the love of God for Israel. And in the Old Testament, you will find references where God says, Israel's my bride, and I love her. And you recognize that that picture is very clearly there. In the New Testament, we have from Paul and from others the idea that we are the bride of Christ. And Christ, the groom, will come and bring us eternally with him. The beautiful passage in John 14, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would tell you. And if I go away, I will come and bring you to myself. That was exactly what a groom would say to his fiancée. Because in those days, in the days of Christ, when a groom, it was arranged mostly by the parents, arranged by the families, but the groom had to prepare everything before he could marry her. Probably helped in construction in those days. You know, if he's having to build a room onto his father's house so that then he could go and claim his bride, I bet he worked fast. Just understand that. And that's a beautiful picture that we have. Christ has prepared a place for us. And the glory of being with him will be eternally, will be wonderful. Now, is it bad to interpret the Song of Solomon that way? No. In fact, I think the underlying truth is there. The love of God for his people, the love of Christ for his church. But if you stop there, if that's all it means, I think you've missed part of what is the purpose of God in this story. We could say it's just a collection of poems for Jewish weddings. Not wrong, because it has been used and is still being used. Not just Jewish weddings. We had a beautiful wedding when we were in Russia. And the two, they felt a little embarrassed to read in front of people, but they taped it. And they were played, the voice of her longing for her beloved, and the voice of him longing for his love. And by the way, when you're trying to figure out who's talking, you note that she always calls him my beloved, and he always calls her my love. So that maybe will help you a little bit. But I think the purpose of the book here, and the wisdom that we can gain from it, is the wisdom of God celebrating the crowning glory of his creation. The gift of love, and the gift of love that includes a physical expression between men and women. That's not something somebody else thought up. That is God's plan, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful. So, I think that the book is, first of all, a correction of what man has done to physical love. We tend to take, with just about everything, extremes. And the extremes with the physical love is either hedonism, what we've done mostly in the West, where we have excesses of using sex outside of marriage. In fact, we've cheapened it and disengaged it from love, and basically we've made it a marketing tool. If you watch television, and I don't necessarily recommend it, but I do some, and you look at commercials, you will be hard-pressed to see very many commercials that do not use some kind of attraction between men and women as part of the commercial. That's what the West has done with it, and that's despicable. It is cheap, and it has cheapened the beauty of the love between a man and a woman. The problem is that the East has gone to the other extreme. Not all the East, but parts of the East, and they've gone to an asceticism that has made sex totally taboo. And when I say that word, some of you, because of your cultural upbringing or because of your background, cringe a little bit. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to not make you cringe. But I want you to understand that God didn't make something dirty and ugly and hidden. He made something beautiful. And in the Eastern culture, it is hidden, unmentionable, and considered dirty. Women are hidden or exploited, or both. And that's the truth. Women are covered completely, not allowed to speak, put away, but at the same time exploited. Those are the extremes. Those are both wrong. God gave us this beautiful Song of Songs to help us understand that this is a beautiful thing. A love between a man and a woman, and the physical part of that, is a beautiful thing that God has created for us to rejoice in and to celebrate in the proper place. The proper place being married between two people. Secondly, it's a glorification of the physical love between a man and a woman. It's not pornographic. It's not obscene. It rather, it lifts it up with frankness and purity. Now, because we're Western, most of us are anyway, when we read those descriptions, you saw the drawing there, when we read those descriptions that your teeth are like a flock of sheep that all match each other, and your neck is like a tower, we don't really get very turned on by that. It's not to be a visual thing, okay? But the beauty of what God has created is to be glorified, and it's glorified in this. But thirdly, I believe that this is a poetic teaching of the meaning of true love. And there's some elements, and I just named five here, or four here. You could probably find some more as you read through the book, if you're over 30. If you're under 30, ask your parents. Maybe they'll let you read it. Number one, love means giving to one another. As you read the book, there is no sense of I want, I possess, I have. It is more giving. Secondly, love is a fire. The scripture was read there. I want to read it again. This is a New Living Translation. In chapter 8, kind of the summary of what love is all about, it says this: place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Its jealousy as enduring as the grave. Love flashes like fire, the brightest kind of flame. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can rivers drown it. If a man tried to buy love with all his wealth, his offer would be utterly scorned. Love is the most mysterious, wonderful gift God has placed in our hands, and it reflects the great love he has for us. But it also is a reality in our life, and we need to understand that love is a powerful thing. From California, where I grew up, to Oklahoma, where my wife was in school, should be driven in maybe 2 days or 3 days if you take it easy. But when we were courting, and she was at Bartlesville, and I was in California, I told her I was coming back early for school. That was to work. Of course, I told her I was coming back to work. But I really wanted to see her. I started out, and I had written her and said, I will stop at my brother's house in Southern California, spend the night there, and then I will stop at a motel one night, and on the third day, I'll be there. And then I started down to my brother's house, and after a couple hours with my brother and his family, I thought, well, this is kind of boring. I really would like to spend more time with Marilyn. I think I'll skip that first night. And so off I went. I also thought it was very clever because you drove through the desert areas of America at night. So I felt really good about myself and my old car that didn't have air conditioning. And I drove through the night, and then I'm thinking, okay, I should stop here somewhere. Oh, but I was really tired then, but I'm kind of refreshed. The morning, the light, sun's coming up, and the air feels good. Roll down the window, let the air blow in on me, and I drove a little longer. Then it's about noon, and I'm thinking, you know, in just another 8 hours, I could be there. And so I pressed on. to be there. And I arrived at 10 o'clock the next night. I had driven clear through, and she wasn't there. But the point is, if somebody had said to me, Kent, here's what you got to do. You got to get in that car, and you got to drive straight through from California to Oklahoma without stopping. I would have said, you're crazy. No money would do that. For money, they wouldn't do it. But for love, you do a lot of things. And you can all tell stories just as good as that one. I know. Love is very powerful. But it must be controlled because, like fire, it could destroy. It means loyalty and faithful commitment to one another. It cannot be rushed. That's one of the reoccurring themes. Do not rush love before its time. You can understand that in a number of ways, but very clearly, if the physical love is not kept in its proper bounds, it destroys love itself. And I don't know how many times I've talked to couples who later in their marriage, they've had trouble. And it stems back to the fact that they did not wait for marriage. And there's a difference. It makes a difference. If marriage is worth waiting for, and love that God has given us as a gift is worth waiting for, it's so much better in our lives. And it causes us to be strong. If we don't wait for gratification, then it causes weaknesses. Now, it doesn't mean you can't get over those. But it means that it will probably have to be dealt with at some point in your marriage. It brings up lots of doubts. I've talked to couples over and over again, and they say, well, I'm not sure if he's being loyal to me. And usually when I hear that, I know that they did not wait because they have doubts about the loyalty of the trust of the other one. And that comes in when you don't wait, okay? Again, I'm not trying to step on any toes here. I'm just telling you, that's really what happens. Love is hurt when we do not wait for the proper time. What are some lessons we can learn from the Song of Songs? First of all, true love is about choosing and being the right mate. It's not some chemical attraction, okay? I've read books that said, yeah, it's all animal, you know? The person puts off a certain smell and we're our animal instincts and like... That's not true. It's not true. We should enter into love by choosing and seeking the one. And if God grants that in our life, we find that over and over again, that the choice is not only right for the moment, it's right for the life. We find it again and again. It comes up. Marilyn completes me. And I had a lot to be completed, and still do. And over and over again, I see how wise God was to give me such a wife. So love is about choosing and being the right mate, not some physical reaction. Love is worth waiting for. It's ruined by not waiting. I've already mentioned that. True love should be protected and preserved from marriage. It is constantly attacked by our enemy. One of the recurring themes of the enemy's attack on the church is in this very area of attacking in the area of sexuality. True love, the next one, true love is understanding the affectional needs of your mate. It's about giving pleasure, not receiving. There's some practical applications. Okay, let me read the bottom line first because I know some of you are not married. If you're not married, understanding the depths of God's love for you and Christ's love for you in this book is appropriate. And you can gain great things from that. You don't have to be married to enjoy the book of the Song of Solomon. He is the one who calls you to his banqueting table. He is the one who puts his banner of love over you. And you will see hundreds of such pictures if you're reading it as a single person, seeing how much God cares for you, okay? So I don't want to rule that out. I want you to understand that. But here's some practical applications primarily for those who are married. Number one, give your spouse the attention that he or she needs. Take time to truly know your spouse, to know what their needs are. Sometimes we talk about languages of love, and different people have different languages of love. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about them, but some people, they feel loved when they get a gift. Other people feel loved when people spend time with them. Other people feel loved when it's verbally expressed. My wife loves to hear me say, "I love you." Sometimes she even asks me, "Have you told me that?" Yeah. And you've heard the story of the old guy who said his wife, they went to a counselor, and his wife says, "He never tells me he loves me." And he said, "I told you once, I haven't taken it back, have I?" Women, most women would love to hear it more than just once, okay? But you need to find out what it is that causes your mate to feel loved. What is it? And you need to remember that you should not only communicate in your language, but in hers. Now, that should be easy for us to understand as an international church, shouldn't it? We speak lots of different languages here. And yet, how can we communicate when we speak a language we all know? Okay, I'm kind of thankful it's English in this group. But if I want to go to another land and I want to really communicate love, I need to learn the language. It's just that simple. Number two, encourage and praise your spouse for their strengths. You will not see in this book a lot of criticism about, you know, but you look how you did your hair, or you know where were you for this? And it's not there. And it ought to be a lesson that we pick up on and understand. Avoid criticism and praise the strengths. You say, "Can I never say anything negative?" Okay, 9 praises, then you can get 1 criticism in. Okay, that's the rule. Some of you'll be home counting. Number 3, enjoy each other. Plan to keep the love fires burning. Marriage was meant to be enjoyed by God. Have date nights. Some of you don't understand what that is. I mean, that's time alone, just the two of you. If you have 27 kids, find a babysitter who's crazy, who will watch them. Anybody who would watch 27 kids is crazy, okay? Take time away. Delight in God's gift. It's a wonderful gift. Delight in it. Number 4. Reassure your commitment to each other often. Often. Someone has said, "We're going to do that marriage renewal thing again. As long as I'm pastor, we'll do it at least once a year." Okay? So if you missed it last time, we'll do it again. So you'll have a chance just to announce your love to each other. And whether you do it in front or somewhere else, that's okay. You can, but announce that love to each other. It's a wonderful thing. Work through problems promptly. What does the Bible say? The Bible says that you can be angry longer in the summer than in the winter. Because it says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. My wife and I noted that when we were in Russia, we were up a little bit further, that we could be angry until 10, 11 o'clock at night. That's not really the meaning of the word there. Deal with problems promptly. Don't go to bed angry at each other. Work it out. I was talking to one couple, and they said, "We'll never sleep." I said, "Well, better never sleeping and dying of lack of sleep than killing each other. So come on, keep working at it. Work out problems promptly. And number 5, seek God's best for yourself and for your mate. What's missing that breaks my heart? What I see missing in Christian marriages is praying together. That breaks my heart, folks. God gives you a mate, and it's a wonderful gift of God. You should be using that opportunity. You should be praying together, reading the Word together. Maybe you read it separately, but talk about it together. Find a way that you pray and worship together, because that's what God had intended when He brought you together. This is a wonderful book, full of wisdom. It's just that you have to dig it out. It's kind of like gold, you know. It's not laying on top of the ground. You got to dig it out. And it's a very good illustration for love. Is love easy? I could pull all the men here, but I won't do that. No, it's not. Love. I would pull the women, and they would say, most of the time. At least I hope they would say most of the time. Is it easy? No, it's not always easy. Is it wonderful? Yes, it is wonderful. And God has given us a book, dedicated a book in the Bible, one of 66, to deal with this area in our life. I think when I talk about this, I'm going to talk for me, okay? When I talk about the purity and the depth of the love that I see in this book, I within me have two reactions. One is I realize how far short I have fallen in showing the kind of love that God wants. And I feel like repenting. That's an okay response. And the other response that I have is that, wow, I need to get on the ball and show how much I appreciate the gift that God has given to me. And that's an okay reaction too. And I don't know if you have one of those two reactions, but I just want to pray for you. Will you let me pray for you? Father, you know our marriages. And you know the struggles that every marriage has gone through. And you know the times that we personally feel like we've really messed it up. We've really failed. We failed our mate, and we failed you. And we would ask for forgiveness for those times, Lord. And you know, Father, that your word tells us over and over and over again that we should express our gratitude. Gratitude to you, and gratitude to one another. And that's the will of God. That's the plan of God in our homes, that we should be overwhelmed by the goodness of God, and giving thanks to each other, and giving thanks to God. Help us to do that better, Lord. Help us to learn those ways that are most meaningful to our mate, whether it's giving a little gift, or spending some time, or taking a walk, whatever it is. I pray that you will give us wisdom as men of God to love our wives, and as women of God to love our husbands, and to encourage and bless each other in your word. We pray it in Christ's name.